Hey everybody, we're back with LA Lit, as you know, since you downloaded it, with Matt Vey and Anna, and we're going to hear some of their work now. Matt Vey is going to start us off with the present work, which is forthcoming from Palm Press in spring and soon of this year.
We're ready. If you want to tell us anything about it as a whole, and then...
I'll just say that, that's loud.
Right.
I'm going to, there's not much to say. Either I could talk a lot about it or just read the little epigraph, I'll choose the latter. So I'll just read the little epigraph. It all started with Gustave Courbet, said Marcel Duchamp in an interview. We said movement, but movement isn't everything. The Coca-Cola fizzing and then suddenly not fizzing anymore, perhaps never to fizz again. Inventions got the better of us, so we decided to throw ourselves away, and the inventions stayed put. They were all we had left. So I invented something that spun around and around on a chair and called it water, and something to sit on without falling down and called that mirror. I had a firm grasp of it, and from since onwards, I was in love with jogging and coming home, the key flat under the welcome mat for dinner. I didn't like my name, and so I signed all of it Mongrel. Mongrel thought he was better than me, and I hit him with a lazy boy under which he behaved like a hermit. We've had enough of choice. Choice is over. It went out the window with the experiment. You've got a lot of nerve not to like it. Day laborers, migrant workers, gleaners, poets, communards, artists, come on, they don't exist anymore, only we exist then. Meanwhile, in the Cafe of Mirrors, waiting for the beautiful lady. Meanwhile, the haystacks burning in the outlying quarters. Meanwhile, the rolling theater, cardboard walls and paper windows, Arlecchino smashing through the pane. Angels without technique, crashing into glass, leaving flat traces of angel art. But let's not talk about the uses. Let's instead define the reasons. Definition: a minister of culture hoards bills and bundles the workers' watch in white work coats, stained with fading red as he is pushed into the car behind glass bars, glass of the TV, a kind of window, a kind of water, a kind of mirror. Appearance stripped for our pleasure. We got a kick out of going public. Take a picture of me, says our hero, posing for a painting. Real became realer as the real spun grainy impressions of a time already passing, first colorless, then blooming before our very eyes. Gustave Courbet, what are you doing in the hay? Between flashes, Gustave could almost draw a blank. A sameness of what will come, the thresher in the waking field, but in this cringing mind of the glass, cracked, busted, out for the count is like opium standing up. Romantic authenticity, to the boards, out the painted window, synapse substituted for chasm, bar for barricade. Gustave on the road, dirty socks, shaving without a mirror, smoking the shake of the last metro cigarette. I've had nothing but coffee to eat. Commiserate with me. And you're complaining about the escargot in your teeth? Take this toothpick and solve the world's problems. We have a lot, but nothing to give away. Take this kid's poems, he's only in sixth grade. A sheaf of notes, unwritten novellas, like supernovas, climb inverse into the night. What an idiosyncratic psychogram, reducible to a gram of writing. Suit yourself, recede, erase. I will follow you, little water, wherever you run. Your syntax betrays your worldview, am I right? Have you innovated? You must have done it linguistically, loading the dice. Synopsis. 9 one-eyed men wait for the healer in the emergency room with colorful magazines on three-dimensional paper. Meanwhile, no matter how we look at things, the thing remains the same thing. The smokestacks looming over haystacks by now, the poets playing at being free turned the boulevard inside out looking for golden lines of sweet Paris powder. Sound the alarms of literature. If they do not sound now, they must be broke. The Chinese garden has one Jewish tree. The next part was a little better. The next part was a little letter. Gustave, could you have imagined youth desiring to be told what to do as if they were old? Gustave, could you have known the poor would honor fear on their knees for war? Gustave, You're not the one to ask. You painted blades of grass as if they didn't exist apart from one another or the canvas. There's a dilemma I can't solve. Who made the law? Who broke the law? Who folded it into the book? Nature? Nurture? What did the revolution teach us? Whose idea was it that ideas were limited to ideas? The abstract shape, call me Lucy, was hanging on the wall of the apartment that I'd left behind. It was the name of a child of paint that you had with someone I didn't know well. Time trucks by my windows wherever I go. Nobody gives you a break in this life. Charmed, I'm sure. We painted ourselves into a corner, back to an opaque window, but soon the angels portrayed by right angles got angry at being portrayed by a square root, at least before they were portrayed in mangers as children, white, or at least as youth. Simplicity left us when it left us complicated. Since then, we've only had complex thoughts, angular thoughts, and complexes of inferiority. We couldn't be modern. Modern was out of fashion before it turned the century into a factory. In poetry, we found history. Why Gustav? Because I've got to address my complaint to someone who can paint. Paint, then. Don't just lie there. I can't do it for you. I'm a writer, not a painter. Angels, I have the right to say it, without technique, without ruined teeth. Night in the barricades, buildings, antennas, a Coke was burning on the desk, a Coke was burning. Scrap of paper. I came here for the great poem of my little life. I stopped writing. The circle expanded. My pants grew tight at the belt. I'll stop there. It's a long poem, so it's somewhat of the beginning.
Well, tell us a little bit about how it kind of works. It kind of works as a long poem, an epic poem, and it also kind of has these aspects of like a play. You know, you've got Meanwhile and you've got the angel and Back Home Whining as a character, and somewhere in the middle there you have kind of a cast of characters. I don't remember where it was, but hopefully you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do, actually. Somewhere in the middle I divulge the list of the characters who appear in the play or in the poem. And they're characters that are sort of speaking these different parts, mostly because I can't quite figure out which speaking voice I identify with. In this poem, I wanted to kind of create a larger we that's speaking. In fact, a lot of the sort of third quarter of the poem has a lot to do with the differentiation of I and we. The characters came kind of by accident because I wanted, when I was reading this for the first time in public, I was a different version, and I wanted to stop somewhere, have some breathing room in the middle, and explain and sort of give a list of the characters to sort of create a break, and then someone liked it as part of the poem. And it was really hard to tell when I first read this, I think for people listening to it, what parts of the poem were actually parts of the poem and what parts were sort of my comments on the poem or other things. So I started to include more of the external stuff into the poem itself. And actually this edit, this version of it is a little, probably still a little different from what will actually be I guess a final version when it comes out and is published. But it comes from, I guess the whole poem comes from hearing this little tidbit of Duchamp saying that thing about it all started with Gustave Courbet, and trying to figure out what that might mean, or what the history of, I suppose, something we might call the avant-garde comes from. How we would envision that if we were to imagine that it had its source in Courbet, in which case I'm sort of misinterpreting partially, purposefully, this little tidbit of what Duchamp is saying. But a lot of the characters or a lot of the speaking voice in the poem is Duchamp or Courbet or my conversation with them, or so it's all these kind of conversations, I suppose. And then there's like a little playlet in the middle where where Duchamp talks to a bum on the street, and there's some other kind of conversations like that.
I'm inclined to ask if Marcel was kidding when he said that. I mean, what? It's a weird thing. I'm trying to put them together in my mind, and
And I tried to I lingered on a long time because also I extracted myself from the context of the interview and just focused on that one line for this project, and then rethinking it. I think actually what he was talking about is the retinal in art, the way that the painterly surface became most important for the progressive movements of art in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, at which Duchamp revolted against, creating a kind of, I think, in a way, predating a critique of the avant-garde that I think is a worthwhile critique, but one that I have mixed feelings about. Because what he wanted to create was non-retinal art, and sort of the art of the idea, you know. I think that's really what he was getting at, was that Courbet is sort of a primary source for the direction of art which frustrated Duchamp, because you can sort of see in a lot of his later work this aspect of a lot of more traditional painting kind of ideas from particularly medieval and Renaissance painting, like the idea of symbol became so important for him. So there was a lot of, he wanted an art that was concerned with ideas rather than just with the painterly surface of the canvas.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of it. There's two gorgeous Courbets over at the Norton Simon, if you guys have a chance to go over there. Uh-huh. So I was thinking about those and like, okay, thanks.
Yeah. Well, good. Anna, did you want to read? You had something to read again?
Yeah, I should just add that it started as a project, I guess, that I was like it was supposed to be a collaborative project between myself, James Hoff, and Julian Poirier, which James Hoff initiated by asking sort of the question of, or posing a question about the 20th century, or about the wrong 20th century, which is how he phrased it. And he wanted us, the three of us, to write a long poem about the wrong 20th century. What went wrong? And for me, that was catalyst too. About like, so it all started with Gustave Courbet, like this idea of what went wrong, but also where the avant-garde and progress and the idea of progress meet and don't meet and so forth. Mm. So. Sorry, go ahead, Anna.
So you want me to read from the book?
Sure, whatever.
Is there a helicopter in here? So this is an 8-page poem called The Blue Book, and I'll probably read like 5 pages of it because it will get too long. And that's the entirety of my project. There are more trees here than I know what to do with. I don't know any of their names with certainty. My own name has stuck with me since I was very young. I remember the day I learned to spell it with certainty. There are ways to distinguish the trees from each other. These distinctions seem fixed, like the difference between the sexes. How I describe the distinctions varies, though. It seems to become more detailed as I notice more details. First I notice the leaves, and then I notice the bark. This is a kind of progress or progression. I notice color first, then shape, then texture. At least that is how it seems to me on reflection. Progression seems less problematic as a concept than progress. I wonder if that is because it lacks connotations of value. I wonder why value as a concept seems problematic. The introduction of new concepts seems a progression, but toward what? The tree's limbs extend toward nothing or toward each other. The texture of the bark is in a language I don't know. The bark changes in appearance as I progress toward it in space. A language changes in appearance as I learn to decipher its characters. A character marked by difference is never decipherable with certainty. A character marked by familiarity is deciphered with tender certainty. Reflection sheds a problematic light on the concept false. The distance between the concept false and the concept certainty is changeable. The distance between two trees remains constant at the base, but not between limbs. It is therefore both certain and changeable. Many people change their names. Afterward, they are not seen as different by most people. They may have private or public reasons for changing their names. They may change names to buck or bolster tradition, for example. A change may or may not, in fact, buck or bolster tradition. Some people change their sex. They may have private or public reasons for doing so. Afterward, they are seen as different by most people. Some traditions only become buckable with progress. Sex is a noun that can be both active and descriptive. A view of sunlight filtering through trees can seem corny or kitsch. Sex seems to retain the ability to be experienced non-ironically. This may be due to the doubling inherent in sex with another person. Irony may be inherent rather than apparent in this doubling. Heterosexual couples may experience a stronger/weaker doubling than homosexual couples. Couples in which one person takes on the other's name seem to be addressing this doubling. I wonder what that does for them. Name is a word that can be both active and descriptive. Like many people, I like hearing my name spoken during sex. A feeling of intimacy after sex can often be mutual and sincere. This can be true even in a setting of filtered sunlight. Intimacy is only possible because people are seen as different. My name comes from my father's side of the family. I sometimes wish I had a different name or no name at all. I sometimes imagine what sex would be like in a world without names. Pick a background. What background do you want? The sentences are out of the order of progression. The choice is between the beach or the bar. The waves are both apparition and decision. Which wave decision can precipitate a crash? A crash can send you decisively to the bar. Pick one, an apple or apparition. If unjustified, the imperative seems premature. An apple is told to mature by something. It can be seen maturing against its background. The bar can create a background of temptation. The apple also has temptation as its background. Apparitions wash up on the shore of difference. In the filtered sunlight, they enliven their background. Different bars can offer similar backgrounds. A crash can wash you up in one of them. The same beach can offer different backgrounds. This difference depends on the progression of sunlight. A dark beach begins to resemble a bar. This resemblance is an apparition based on the progression towards sex. If unjustified, this resemblance can seem immature. Many backgrounds for the progression towards sex seem corny or kitsch. The beach and the bar are decisively among them. The cultural background dictates certain decisions. These often take on the texture of an apparition or crash. The tree of progress is seen as being rooted in sexual immaturity. Pick a person to have sex with most often. What person do you want? This is a real dream. The character of my experience is often uncertain. When my body is at the bar, my mind may be at the beach. The role played by the mind-body problem is both active and descriptive. The narrative of my life stems from nothing but my life. It is therefore both certain and changeable. Narrative is a concept with a problematic background. It laughs in a language I can't decipher with certainty. I once woke up laughing from inside a dream. There was somebody sleeping next to me at the time. My laughter seemed more real to that somebody than the dream. The dream seemed more real to me than that somebody. The balance of my experience shifted as my limbs tended toward him. I rarely remember the narrative of my dreams. Some people say antidepressant drugs cause vivid dreaming. They report perfect recollection of their dreams. I wonder if this means my dreams are faint or only my recollection. I rarely remember lived experience with certainty either. The concept of depression is seen as a sign of progress. The inventions of technology have made human memory less critical. Critical is a word that can be used in more than one way. The concept unconscious is inherent in many discussions of dreams. The concept agency is inherent in many discussions of life. I believe there are languages without names for these concepts. It is tempting to think of these concepts as signs of progress. It is equally tempting not to. Reality woke up laughing from dreaming these sentences. Most judgments are based on surface qualities. We choose to spend time with people we like to look at. The sound of someone's voice can be sexualizing or neutralizing. The axes of perception cannot be mapped with certainty. Some see depth as being opposed to superficiality. This concept can be mapped with a character resembling a cross. Narrative often exploits this surface-depth distinction. An observation on one axis will precede an observation on the other. I wonder about the point at the intersection of the cross. Irony is inherent in this division of perception. As a concept, it can be mapped as a circle drawn around the cross. In Christian culture, the cross is seen as a symbol of strength. The strength of the cross shape is in its intersection. Sex and friendship are often seen as falling on different axes. One may correspond to depth and the other to superficiality. It's said that sex with a new lover is like the creation of a new language. Friendship, like love, often occurs at first sight. Beginners in a new language feel limited to superficial expression. Their narratives are confined to the present tense. Simple tenses can communicate as well or as poorly as complex ones. I love you is a statement both simple and deep. This declaration of sentiment is in most beginning language texts. As a concept, it is seen as non-problematic. In bodies of water, surface and depth intersect on the surface. This is because the surface is a plane while depth is not. Judgments are strengthened when reason and sentiment interact. A new language will tend toward a character for this.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the longer thing.
I'm flitting back here and trying to find a quote, but I think there's something in there where you say, like, you know, concepts may be added, you know, to create some sense of progress or progression, I think you say.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I felt like in reading through this that, not that you started at some, like, you know, base degree zero or something, but I felt like you kept on adding kind of concepts with each page, and then things would be kind of still present on the next page and would kind of keep on building, you know. Not necessarily any way of progress, but it's like just, in some ways, things became more complex, but also you use such a simple language in a way. You know, it's like, and a very, you know, very kind of deliberate language. Like this is, I mean, you don't use contractions most of the time. You know, you don't like let words fall together. It's really interesting. I can talk about that. Maybe you said a lot, but.
Yeah. I guess as far as the kind of language, I was interested in the statement when I wrote this, and I wanted to write statements. I sort of sat down with this blue book one day and thought, what are some, you know, what's a true statement I can write down that'll fill one line of this thing? And I just kept kind of going like that, and so. Why the sentences sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're undeclarative,
yeah.
I guess, most of them with a few questions. I guess, I don't know, I'm always lecturing my students about parataxis, and I never quite thought of this poem in that way, but I guess that's sort of the idea that it's exploring is the difference between putting things next to each other and just having them have no relation of subordination versus the idea of progress, of things, you know, having to move towards something,
yeah,
because they're one after the other.
It's interesting that you bring up that you originally you were wanting to write a true statement, and yet this very much questions certainty and. I mean, working with, I don't want to say dualities even, much less dualisms, but like dual relations of surface and depth and dream and reality and certainty and change. And then where they cross, you mentioned this, but even seem to question mm-hmm. that intersection too. It's all done very well in here.
definitely. I guess the first line is what there's more trees here than I know what to do with. I mean, that was a true statement at the time that I wrote it, but this isn't really. I feel like everybody claims Wittgenstein as a model in poetry these days, and I don't always. I did study philosophy in college, and I've forgotten all of it. But there's. There's a kind of revision, something about Wittgenstein in his biography as well, and the way that he wrote, and then the way that he rewrote and constantly revisited his own statements is something that stuck in my ear at least since forever. And of course, in his last book was called Uncertainty, and while I wasn't specifically trying to respond to that, I realized sort of afterwards, like, ooh, just to go back and read that again.
Well, I don't know if there's any question, if anybody in the audience has any questions for Mafe or Anna about kind of writings or stuff we talked about in the first half. Anybody up for? There's a microphone. You can ask them a question.
Sure. Just
remember to turn the microphone on and say your name and whatnot.
Ask a really hard question.
I was actually going to ask you a question. I'm sorry. In your blue book that you were just reading. I'm Stan Apps, by the way. In your blue book that you were just reading, there are a lot of mentions of irony, and I was struck by the kind of detached way you were sort of speaking about irony, because I usually think of irony as being more or less associated with humor of some type, but it's not here, and it seems that when it's not associated with humor, then it becomes about that one type of irony, situational irony. But I was wondering if you had some more words about the sense in which you were thinking about irony and about what irony means when it's not in the humor context.
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I spend a lot, I teach and I'm constantly confronted by the problem of defining terms such as irony and people misunderstanding or trying to explain things in a way that they make perfect sense. And so I'm not sure that I know exactly what irony means. But I think in this poem, for me, I'm focusing on there's a lot of very literal, it's a very literal poem. And I also, I don't mean it to be totally devoid of the humorous aspect of irony, but sometimes when I read it, it's like, it comes out that way. But I think I think I'm more concerned with ambivalence and things. Just things mean just the doubling that can happen. That irony can exist without us wanting it to in out there and be discovered, as opposed to being necessarily a tool by a writer or by a speaker to communicate on different levels, that it can actually, that it's actually just sort of a reality of life.
It's,
I don't know if that makes any sense.
It makes sense. It seems like in that sense, irony takes on a kind of, a tragic context, right? Because it's about, unpleasant irony.
Not necessarily unpleasant, but a discomfort, like the uncomfortable part of it, I guess, maybe, or the unsettling kind of the toggling that you know, that can be both pleasurable and at times frustrating when something's going two ways at once or having two levels and not, which don't resolve, maybe, or which don't have the dialectic, you know, that nice kind of neat, you know, idea of progress through toggling. If I can use that.
I like that, progress through toggling.
Groovy. Who's next?
I have a Vanessa, please. I have a feeling this might be more like three questions that I'm sort of collapsing into one. But in Matt, when you're talking about Duchamp, talking about this sort of non-retinal aspect of the critique, anyway, and then also with Wittgenstein, it just seemed like both there was a certain insistence on the ordinary, but that insistence was against a pre-existing artifice and a pre-existing sort of romanticization of art. And I guess my question for both of you is, okay, now we've had a good 30 to 40 years of the ordinary. And we live in a culture which the culture at large celebrates the ordinary. And I also know that your books are not ordinary. And so what is it in your work where you're what is the not ordinary that you're juxtaposing your ordinariness to in order for it to be something different than just the ordinary?
That's a phenomenal question. You got to the bone. Do you have an answer right off the top of your head? So what is the not ordinary that we're, the ordinary that is not ordinary that we're juxtaposing to the ordinary?
Well, in both of your work, you're still using, you're using the language of the ordinary, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a dominant poetics that was not ordinary, then the use of the ordinary language would be, there would be a tension just in the use of it, but there isn't.
Can you define what you mean by
ordinary? Okay, well, I'll use a really extreme example, mm-hmm. because then that'll maybe clarify. But for example, okay, so let's look at Wordsworth. Let's go back to Wordsworth. So you've got high artifice in terms of form. So the use of ordinary language in a highly artificial form creates its own tension. When Duchamp's doing the Ready Made, it's a part of a conversation he's having with art. But there's another side to the conversation. The problem is that in my mind, in terms of the avant-garde, Duchamp won. Okay, we've had, post-Duchamp, it's all been the ordinary and conceptual art and things like that. I guess what I'm interested in my work and in the work of others is, where's the point of tension? And in the point of tension is the point of distinction. So where's the point at which, so when I look at your books, for example, the construction of them is obviously not ordinary. You know, when you walk around and look at all the books there are. So there's the container, which is not ordinary. The language inside, depending on the book, may or may not be ordinary. But obviously when you're sitting down and writing something, or for me, there's always that problem of how do you use language that has a certain kind of ordinariness, a certain kind of communicative aspect, but you have to create almost your own resistance.
Well, I mean, I really agree with you for the most part in terms of your definition and in terms of your the way that you've kind of framed after Duchamp the victory of the ordinary, and you know, you can look at William Carlos Williams or whoever, mm-hmm. right? And Creeley or whatever, you know, and in poetics, but you could talk, but then there is I think a tendency in the sort of late language school towards which also has tensions between ordinary and the non-ordinary and the whole language of postmodern criticism, which is perhaps less ordinary, right? In some sense, the thing that I find that in Anna's piece and a lot of Anna's writing, and I think in some of my writing, and a lot of more often in my writing, a tendency towards simplification in a sense, which I don't think is necessarily avant-garde now. I'm not saying that it is, because as you say, there is this tendency or this prevailing kind of spirit of the ordinary. But then again, you have, in some ways, I read a lot of submissions that we get, right? And a lot of the time I feel that the language is, a lot of poets are trying to do something on the surface with the language that is extraordinary, right? But often I don't see something, a tension or interesting tension to me between that language and or the content and in spite of its form, I don't see in the content something that would get me excited to, you know, in terms of a conflict with prevailing ideology. And also, I see a lot of writing that is that seeks in a kind of complex, more more technical language. Whether it's people writing with using sort of like a computer or biological terminology to inform the writing of poetry, or in this sort of specialized way, right, or various language-oriented project or language school-oriented projects, I find in that kind of overcomplexification a lack of really coming up against what has been and or what is in the call. I mean, it just feels to me somewhat limiting in terms of saying something. And I'm worried in my work, at least. I get a little bit worried I don't want to expand my vocabulary in a sense. I've tried to make it as poor as possible in some ways. And even though I don't want my experience to be poor, I want to take from all sorts of experiences to widen that. But I also don't want to, I find it distracting to over complexify the language. And so I often just repeat word, you know, like the same words over and over again. And I guess that lends itself to sort of towards the tradition of the ordinary, right? In which case, you know, I feel like, yeah, I think that there's a certain part of me that sticks with the traditional avant-garde, if you can call it traditional, right? But then a certain part of me that is upset at how that went, you know, what happened, and with particularly with the I mean, the urinal, the ready-made urinal, its value later as art, monetary value as a reproduction of the ready-made, or all the fetishism that goes along with Warhol or whatever, right? With mass-produced objects, is disconcerting, and I think runs against a lot of the sort of the positive things that I think of when I think of that strain of art. And so I don't know. I've always thought that for the books, I've always thought that what's important is an element of surprise. We always have wanted them to stick out to some degree, at least either in roughness or in some way, right? And perhaps in some ways, usually that's achieved by really simple things, by having one pass with the letterpress as opposed to a Photoshopped image, right? So those kind of really, I mean, in a lot of ways, very, it is a simplification of visual language that makes some of our books look like Ugly Duckling books, I think. Would you agree with that? No. That last part. I don't mean the babbling that I just did before that. But I don't know. It's a really hard question. I don't know where currently I would, what I would say, I think, on that front in terms of my own work. But I think it's just hard to create mass-produced objects. And since we're making books in a larger room, what we're interested in that is not making a small edition for the most part, but making something that is a little bit more accessible price-wise or, you know, in quantity. We have to deal with the idea, well, are we creating a mass-produced object? How do we keep that mass-produced object from feeling mass-produced, right? I mean, I guess 1,000 isn't, like a book that has a run of 1,000 isn't really mass-produced in this world when you have, you know, those action figures or whatever produced in many more thousands. But there is still a sense of like, well, how do you keep something of the hand of the human being in the creation of objects? And I think that kind of goes against conceptual ideas in some ways, right? I mean, the books themselves are to be kind of have a touchable quality, I think, that kind of goes against the conceptual aspects, perhaps, of some of the contents. But in terms of writing, for me, that has to do with very simple things like awkwardness. I mean, that's how that aesthetic kind of translates to my own writing. But I don't know. I think I've gone on way too long. So why don't you go on? Go ahead and try to answer that.
Yeah, I don't know that I can at all. But briefly, I guess I would say that I don't. I have a hard time seeing things in a way that makes your question make sense for me personally. So much. I mean, in the sense of, I don't see things. I certainly don't see my own writing literary historically. I just am not that kind of, I can't keep things in my head in that way. And I'm not trying to be avant-garde, and I'm not trying to necessarily be different or anything. And I don't necessarily agree that the tension, I guess the tension that I definitely, you know, probably from acting classes in sixth grade, you know, swallowed the idea that there has to be tension or for art to be interesting, that there has to be conflict or what have you, but I don't think that, necessarily the tension between content and form, or register of voice, and you know, like the Wordsworth example that you brought up, is where that's going to locate itself necessarily. So, and I guess seeing tension as a product of two things that seem to not go together is one way of seeing tension, but not necessarily where I'm going to try and find it or find the interesting point of friction in writing. So I don't know, and I'm also just not sure that I still don't totally understand what the statement about the word, you know, like saying Duchamp won or whatever. I'm uncomfortable with those kinds of statements, because I just have a hard time, as maybe it was obvious from the poem that I read,
I have a hard time coming down wholly in one position, holding a position.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not saying whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Sure.
I just think it's a thing.
Yeah.
And I think in your work, for example, the tension that I see is the use of the parataxis.
Uh-huh.
And that's its own tension. I don't think tension's necessarily conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, it's a frame. It's a way mm-hmm. of framing things. And so I guess, I mean, there really is no answer, I don't think. I think it's just a question of, we're talking about words.
Mm-hmm.
And the words are the paint that we're using, and so how do you treat the paint? And what's the paint supposed to do? And I think that small presses are the place where people are doing the most interesting experiments with the paint.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, I was listening to an article on the radio. I was listening to whatever you listen to on the radio. An interview with somebody, an astrophysicist, about multiple dimensions, and, you know, had that experience where I was listening to mass media, you know, NPR or whatever, and I could not get my head around what this person was saying, and neither could the host, and neither could probably most of the people listening. The idea of imagining, you know, we finally got our head around three dimensions, and okay, the fourth is time, and then, oh, maybe there's 11, 12, 13. How do you conceive of those? And how can you, and the host, who was really in over his head, was trying to, you know, he was kind of saying, well, so we're living in three dimensions, but you mean I'm actually also living in 11 dimensions? Are they next to me? Are they next to me?
Yeah.
And he was trying to find a way to, and she, it was impossible for this woman, this person, to communicate what kinds of concepts she had in her head when she was doing her work, and she has apparently just written a book for the layperson, which I'm gonna have to go out and read because I, you know, whatever ways she was trying to explain on the radio weren't working for me. But anyway, my point being that with small presses, I think that that somehow, I mean, this is a totally lame analogy, but all the different things that I was bringing up, the ways things are distributed, you know, the way that the thing is made, the experiment, the way that the paint is, the palette is constantly being enlarged in ways that involve the way the culture is changing, and how every movement that makes a book go into the world becomes part of that book, and that maybe we're using, you know, paints whose colors we don't even recognize yet, or you know, as publishers and as people participating in this constantly evolving, you know, conversation. So maybe it's an open question.
I found it really fascinating what you're saying, and I think I'd like to think about it and talk about it more with you. But I think my brain won't do it now.
Does anybody else have questions? No? All right. Well, do you guys want to read a couple short pieces? And then
maybe
we'll,
one each.
One each, and then we'll just, yeah. We'll call
or
it a night.
You can do two, I don't know.
I don't think I'm going to read anything.
Yeah, after that. Okay, why don't I just read this thing, and Anna will choose something meanwhile, because I chose it beforehand, and now if I tried to choose something else, I would be really flustered. So it's called Buttons. This text is written on buttons so tightly sewn to each other that no one can read it. Clarify. This text is written on the inside side of many buttons, all of which are sewn together in a necklace of buttons so that you can't even see the text. In fact, the beaded and contiguous nature of these buttons makes it impossible to even know which side of each button is its inside side. In the necklace of buttons, sides don't matter. Every side touches is in contact. Even so, the text is written only on the inside side, the side which was once in contact with, was touching the clothing people wore, the clothing of the people who once wore it, but now do not wear the clothing because it does not have buttons. During the war, all the buttons fell off. Those that didn't fall off were cut from the clothing of the people. No, the buttons no longer touch the clothing. Instead, they touch each other on all sides. Buttons have two sides and two sides only. At least these buttons. No one can read this text. It's on the buttons, and the buttons touch, and so there's no room for an eye to get in there in between the buttons. No, the buttonholes don't help either. They're stuffed with thread, the thread that keeps the buttons touching. These buttons are a sort of entertainment, you might say. Their holes are full of thread, their sides touch. Not even imaginary characters can read the text, not even a thought experiment. Boris can't read it, even if I asked him to. Benita Canova can't read it, nor can Nietzsche. The real one can't, and the imaginary one, too. The buttons are so close together, you can't even unbutton them, you can't even imagine them. These are real buttons. My friends can't read the buttons, and you? I don't even know my friends, because on one side they are my friends, and on another they're somebody else's friend. Yours, maybe, their own, definitely. Imaginary, perhaps, yes. The buttons, the buttons. I've never been so afraid of buttons.